London dropped its dignity.
Yeah.
So has France and Germany.
Yeah.
All hands are dancing to a raggedy melody full of originality.
Sing it, though.
Hello and welcome to Yesterday's Chip Paper, the fortnightly-ish podcast where we look at the bizarre and the macabre and the strange and the downright absurd that we find in the historic newspapers. My name is Violet.
And I am Jim. We are transatlantic amateur researchers who are really passionate about old newspapers. I just want to clarify, actually, because I am in the States, fortnightly is 2 weeks. That isn't a thing here, I discovered recently. So it means roughly every 2 weeks.
It's good that we sent you all the way out there to do that market research for this podcast.
I am the cultural attaché of, of niche podcasts. Hopefully the current administration sees my use and doesn't deport me.
They're like, no, get your hands off this man when the immigration forces come.
He knows what fortnightly means. He knows the difference between metric and imperial and can readily conjure what 16 ounces is in grams. So yes, it means fortnightly. And we, every couple of weeks, will get together and tell each other what we found in old newspapers, whether that's forgotten mutinies or cases of mass hysteria.
Both.
Missing people who weren't really missing.
All three of which are fantastic episodes, which, if you have not listened to...
It would have been strange, I think, if I'd have just plucked those three things out of the air. I think it was probably implicit. But yeah, no, they are good episodes. I think they're our last three episodes, so go back to listen to 6, 7, and 8. But this is episode 9, and this time it is the turn of Violet to tell me about a story that she has found in the newspapers.
You did mention that we hadn't done murder for the last two episodes. So I've got us right back on track.
Yes.
With a wonderful murder. Well, murder is never wonderful. I should just put that disclaimer in.
Yeah, I don't want to be that kind of podcast.
Let me take that bit out. But with a terrible murder.
Yeah.
But it is really fascinating. And it is just the kind of story that is just so... You forget that it actually happened to real people. It is very dark.
Right.
So... This week, I'm covering the story of a crime that shot a small town in Pennsylvania to international fame in 1928.
What's the town?
The town is York in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And
so the fame didn't last.
It didn't.
Then.
Well, see, the still in the area today, the area is known as, I think it's known as Raymayer's Hollow, and everyone who lives around the area knows the story still, and the teenagers will go and do like midnight parties and go. And because I haven't actually mentioned, this is a story that contains witchcraft. So the
Ooh.
Kids will kind of go and like try and summon witches and stuff like that. I did find international newspapers covering this from the time.
Okay, cool.
Most of the reports that I've taken there have actually been from around the local area, because they were the ones that obviously had all of the details from the trial and everything.
Yeah.
So 2 days before Thanksgiving, 60-year-old Nelson Raymayer is killed in his own home and set on fire by John Blymeyer and his two young accomplices, because they thought that he had put a spell on them. And not like in a nice kind of Nina Simone way.
I mean, it could have been both.
Well, who knows? But first off, I do just want to give a little bit of background on Nelson, the man who was killed, because...
Nelson Raymayer. Okay.
Because a lot of the newspapers from the time kind of... They described him as this kind of reclusive guy... He was a farmer and he lived in the woods and just a bit odd, and he was meant to be like, he was meant to keep books on witchcraft and practice spells and things like that. And they just kind of painted him to be quite an odd character.
Right.
But actually, looking at some of the census records from the time, he had a lot of family who were living around him in the area. And he did have a wife and two daughters who they did live separately, which will come up later. But
how separately?
So for the last 4 years they'd lived apart, but
how, I mean, how, well, I mean, like, how separately, like next door or next town?
They were in the same town.
I'm wondering if it's like a Helena Bonham Carter and Tim Burton.
Oh, I see. Where... I don't think they had adjoining houses, but like they were in this, they were in the same locality. They were very close, especially like if you think of small town America. They were very, the Rainmayers were basically very highly concentrated in this area. And even the guy who, the enumerator of the census was, I think, a Gilbert Rainmayer. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, and like the family were really well known. So it doesn't seem like he was really that odd. And to put the witchcraft thing into perspective, the area where it took place had historically one of the largest populations of the Pennsylvania Dutch, which was a culture formed by early settlers in the late kind of 17th century, where they did practice, probably call it witchcraft in the terms that probably describes what they're doing, like making spells and things like that. And all of the kind of hex imagery with the stars and things like that does come predominantly from them.
I would be interested in whether they actually did or whether that was just propaganda because they were fled religious persecution.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, regardless, the area was fairly spiritual and people did have these books that had spells and things in them.
Right. So what we're talking about a place that historically has been renowned for people practicing sort of some form of witchcraft.
Exactly.
And still the traditions remained in the early 20th century.
Yeah. I mean, people didn't really actively practice anything, but there were like heirlooms and things like that. So it wasn't so odd for people to have books or things like that in their homes.
That would be the coolest thing to be left by your grandmother or something.
So regardless of the fact that it wasn't that unusual in the area, this guy, John Blymire, who was the perpetrator of this crime, was definitely more radical on the witchcraft spectrum. Well, there is a spectrum there.
No. You can't say he was more radical on the witchcraft spectrum, because it's actually, I don't know if you mean like radical, like cool.
Yeah, true. Okay, so let me just...
Violet will hand illustrate the witchcraft spectrum, and it will be on Twitter after this episode.
And so, I mean, people did notice this guy. He was very odd. He did call himself a witch doctor, and also took advice from other people who called themselves witch doctors in the area.
That's another problem.
This is from the Evening News on the 9th of January, 1929. And it says, John Blymire, tall, thin, young defendant in York's witch murder trial, was called to the witness stand today to give his own version of the killing of Nelson Rainmayer, dabbler in black magic. Blymire rubbed his Adam's apple with his long fingers and gazed interestedly out over the audience. He spoke in a low, clear, colourless voice, and told of feeling bad for 10 years, and of being treated by several doctors. Doc Lenhart, he said, had told him he was bewitched, and others consulted him likewise. So the newspaper doesn't really say whether these are real doctors or witch doctors. So I'm going to presume that Doc Lenhart, which is also, it has the apostrophes around Doc, was a witch doctor.
Amazing.
But
I'm hoping it's not even because it's a shortening. I hope they're just like, yeah, go on then.
That's what it's got on his medical certificate too. Medical
what
certificate.
He calls himself.
So he is reported as seen dozens of doctors over the last decade for various issues which he called curses.
So mental health issues. Or
well, yeah,
issues.
I'll get onto that a little bit later, but it's coming
up
now.
Sorry.
In fact. But the Indiana Gazette also published a statement that said, Dr. Julius Comroe of York, formerly connected with the Philadelphia Hospital, an expert in mental diseases. The doctor had examined Blymire six times since January 23rd, 1923. So that would have been about 5 or 6 years before the crime.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's 5.5 years. Thanksgiving's November.
So he said, Bleymeyer had a fixed idea he was being persecuted. He thought someone was pursuing him. He couldn't eat or sleep, and it affected his health.
Oh, that's horrible.
It was no secret to anyone who knew him that this guy did have quite serious issues. And the Evening News reported that witness after witness told strange tales of John Bleymeyer, who is on trial for the murder of Nelson Reymeyer, seeing goblins romping in his room and witches chasing each other up the walls. Once Bleymeyer saw the picture of Nelson Reymeyer in the palm of his hand, and it was then that he knew he was bewitched, it was testified.
So, did he hallucinated Reymeyer, or he had a photo of him?
I actually don't know for certain, but okay. I'm presuming from his mental state that that was just a hallucination. But he could have had a picture.
Yeah, and also, I suppose in the context of what the article was saying,
was that he...
I guess he was conjured up the image, or his mind conjured up the image.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awful.
Yeah, I mean, also the fact that everyone knew, though, just makes what happens next so much worse. Because if you think about it, that was like 5 years to prepare that they had.
Yeah, you would think the community would be a little sensitive to the fact that this man is seeing goblins in his bedroom.
But they weren't. Until...
I suppose that's what happens when you rely on all your medical care for witches.
Well, exactly. This is until he met Mrs. Emma Knopp, who the Evening News reports was an aged, bent, and almost toothless powwow doctor.
I'm not sure there's any need for that, but okay.
Who allegedly told Bleymeyer to get a hold of a lock of Reymeyer's hair and bury it. He was then to find a book that Reymeyer supposedly had in his possession called Long Lost Friend, which was a book written in 1820 by a healer of the Pennsylvania Dutch.
Okay.
It had like spells and prayers, but also like recipes for beer and things in it. She said that if...
That sounds great.
It sounds like a fascinating thing to have been left probably by a relative.
And I'm here sort of pouring scorn and calling a hokum on witchcraft and things. Like, I appreciate that historically witchcraft wasn't flying around on broomsticks and eating toads and things. It was, you know...
It was religion, like, basically.
Local women who were... Well, it was like the sort of the cunning women in England is what they were called. They, there was local people who would help when people were ill.
Yeah.
You know, they would make... not potions, but like salves. And
yeah, that was the kind of thing that was in this book.
Yeah, that's what they were. And then there was the big witch panic, and I think there was they added a bit of mysticism in for the placebo.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert on this, but yeah. I'm not sitting here being like witches.
Like, yeah, like historically.
I appreciate that.
So. This woman said to Bleymeyer that if he got a hold of this book and destroyed it, that the curse that Nelson supposedly had over him would be broken.
So he has to go and get a lock of Nelson's
hair,
and he has to burn a book that Nelson
owns. And destroy a book, yeah.
Okay.
But Reymeyer didn't want to do that on his own. So he went about trying to recruit some people to help him. The first recruit was called Wilbert Hess, and he was about 18 or 19 at the time. All of the ages in this kind of went up and down, not just from the year of the newspapers, but just people recording different ages. But
yeah, standard.
So Hess was the son of a local family who also believed that they had been cursed by Nelson Reymeyer. And this comes from Wilbert Hess's statement at the later trial. He says, I got acquainted with Bleymeyer through my father, Milton J. Hess, who lives at York Township at the Pennsylvania Tool Company at York less than a year ago. Bleymeyer was a powwow doctor. Bleymeyer and Bleymeyer's friend came to our place at York Township less than 6 months ago. My father had trouble with the neighbours, Ida J. Hess, about a right of way. Bleymeyer made my father believe that he could help us out of this trouble. And Bleymeyer had a book, and Bleymeyer said he would get us rid of this trouble. Bleymeyer told my father that it would cost $40 or $50, and my father gave Bleymeyer $10.
That's not the same.
Our chickens got away, and Bleimeyer tried to make my father believe he could find whether the chickens were stolen or killed. Bleimeyer had my father write a few lines, and I believe this was to be out of the Bible. And he also reported that he'd seen Bleimeyer solemnly powwowing a road which had been close to the family by reading to it from a book.
Right, so this is Bleimeyer, who is the chap who's in court. This isn't the victim.
This is Bleimeyer, who would later go on to kill Nelson, who's calling himself a witch doctor as well.
Right, okay.
And that was a statement from Wilbert Hess, who would be one of his accomplices.
Right. Okay, the unfortunately named Hess.
So then Hess's brother also told of Bleimeyer's strange visits to the family home. So he said that he came to the place and talked about the spell that Raymayer had cast over my family. He asked me to drive out to the woods near Raymayer's place. He said he wanted to get some of Raymayer's hair. He said he would dig a hole and put it 8 feet underground, and in that way would break the spell.
Eight feet. My God. That's so deep.
And in that way would break the spell he had cast over my father and mother. The next day, the day of the murder, he said he needed help in the job. He said Raymayer was so big he would need someone to hold him while he started to cut the lock from his hair. He asked me to go with him and help him do it, but I refused.
Good.
I mean, at that point you...
Can I just interject and say, I'm sorry, when you were saying the lock of hair and the book stuff, I assumed that the approach that they would take to this is do it while he's asleep.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense.
You wouldn't even know if they did it
stealthily enough.
You just need one guy to look at the bookshelf, one guy to get the hair, and then just skedaddle. And then just start digging for the next 14 and a half hours.
The next 14 years. It did not end up like that, though.
Right. Okay.
So, the parents of Wilbert Hess were just really into this idea.
Really?
Yeah. And not just Mr. Hess, who had kind of got Bleimeyer to help him, but Mrs. Hess also said to her son Wilbert, "If getting a lock of Raymayer's hair is the only way we can cure our troubles, then go get it."
That's so... I'm not going to say it's stupid.
And there was another report. I didn't snip it, but it was just... It was the son saying, "Yeah, like I had to go to work that day, but my mum was like, oh no, you can take a day off work for this. This is important.
You can take a day off work to go and shave a stranger."
So, yes. But it does get worse because the other recruit
was
John Curry, a 14-year-old
right,
who also believed that he was cursed.
You have to admire Raymayer's industry because everyone in this town believes they're cursed by him.
He's got some great salesmanship skills. This does get a bit weird because...
this does get a bit weird. Yes.
Just a little bit.
Does it?
Tiny bit odd. He's described in the papers as a pupil of Bleimeyer. So for the last year or so, it sounds like John Bleimeyer has basically been just brainwashing this kid into like the perfect witchcraft accomplice.
Right.
John Curry's mother said at the trial, "I don't believe in witchcraft, and I can't believe how John got such spooky ideas into his head. It must be that he got under the influence of Bleimeyer. Never have I had any witchcraft books in my home."
I suppose kids are just malleable.
Yeah, having created the perfect accomplice in a 14-year-old and convinced a family to let one of their sons come and help him. The day before the murder, John Bleimeyer and John Curry, the 14-year-old, go to a store and purchase 25 feet of wash line. Nelson Raymayer's wife then testified that the pair had called at her house looking for her husband, and they hadn't. He was not in because he lives separately.
Okay.
They'd gone to his house as well, and he wasn't in, so he just wasn't about. Allegedly, that night, the pair John Blymeyer and John Curry slept at Nelson's house. I don't know if that report is true, right. Because I only found that report.
So he wasn't in, and they slept there?
Yeah, he reportedly wasn't in, and so they slept there.
In the time, if they slept there, in the time that they spent there overnight, they probably could have gone through rugs and things and just found enough of his head hair to convince
Blymeyer. You know what, they could have found the book Blymeyer. As well. They could have, like, saved some time.
Just put a shift in, guys.
I'm actually starting to think that they probably didn't sleep at the house, because that's just... There's stupidity, and then there's just... I don't think that would happen. This is what John Blymeyer said happened on the day of the murder, once the pair had been joined by Wilbert Hess. "We went to Ray Mayer's home. We threw him down. I hit him with a chair. I helped to tie him. I poured oil on the body. I don't know who lit the match."
Yes, you do.
So he's also condensed this murder into, what, 6 very short sentences.
Yeah. You're pouring oil all over somebody. You don't then get to say, "And somebody lit him." I don't know.
However, the Evening News on the 1st of December 1928 reported a very comprehensive statement as given by Wilbert at the trial. And he said, "Blymeyer rapped on the door." So that's the door of Nelson. "Nobody answered."
Yeah.
"Blymeyer called Ray Mayer by name."
So,
sorry, this might get confusing here.
Can I, right. Yeah, also... This isn't going to make any sense to the Americans listening to this, but I keep thinking you're saying Ray Mears.
Oh my God. Ray
the
Mears.
Outdoorsman.
Ray Mears, the witchcraft doctor.
I would believe that Ray Mears was a shaman.
My God.
But yeah, I think he's still working. So
I think he's still okay. We should probably Google that. Yeah. Well, this goes out.
We'll check afterwards, yeah.
So from here on, I'll call Ray Mayer Nelson, because their surnames are a little bit close for comfort.
Thank you. So
nobody answered. Blymeyer called Nelson by name. Nelson lifted the window on the second floor and answered the call of Blymeyer. Blymeyer said to Nelson, "I want to see you," that he, Blymeyer, lost one of his books. Nelson came downstairs and opened the door. Blymeyer asked Nelson whether he saw his book, and Nelson said he saw no book. Nelson said the book may be in the paper rack. Blymeyer said he could not see where he lost the book. Blymeyer pulled away the couch and looked back of it for the book. Blymeyer pushed the couch. Ray Mayer was standing at the table, and then Blymeyer grabbed him around the body and made motions for me to grab Nelson. I grabbed Nelson, and Curry grabbed him too, and then the three of us took hold of Nelson and threw him on the floor. Blymeyer said we must tie his legs to cut his hair. When we had him on the floor, I told Curry to tie his legs so we could cut his hair. Nelson said, "What are you going to do with me?" Blymeyer said he should just be quiet and that we wanted to do something or get something. Nelson then tried to get up and hollered a bit. Then Nelson just about got up, and we put him down again, and Blymeyer had a piece of wood and was hitting Nelson over the head. Then Curry kicked Nelson with his foot, and then Blymeyer reached over and got a piece of wood and told me to hit Nelson. I hit him once or twice over the left ear and the side of the head. Then Blymeyer hit him on the head with a chair and broke the chair. I saw pieces of wood, and I think it was from the chair that Blymeyer hit Nelson with. Blymeyer said, "Give me your money," which I just want to point out was not in the plan at all to start with.
No.
He's just lost the plot at
this point.
Unless
he's going to pay somebody to dig a massive hole.
Nelson gave Blymeyer his money, and Blymeyer put the money in his jacket.
So hang on, Nelson's still...
He's still going.
Alive at this point.
According to all reports, he was quite a kind of tall and large and imposing guy, but apparently he was also really attractive. But this guy just...
Oh.
Yeah, so he was quite... He was able to fight them off for quite a while. So the money was in a pocketbook. Nelson tore Blymeyer's jacket, then Blymeyer hit Nelson again. Curry went and got the rope off the couch, and I took it from Curry and tied Nelson's hand and told Blymeyer he should cut the hair. I told him 3 times to cut the hair. Then Blymeyer said we would put the rope around Nelson's neck. Blymeyer lifted Nelson's head. and told us to put the rope under Nelson's neck. And Curry put the rope under. And then Curry and Blymeyer fastened it. And then Curry pulled the rope, and Blymeyer said, "Choke him." And Curry pulled the rope so tight that I could not hear Nelson breathe anymore. Curry wanted to take Raymeyer's shotgun along. I said, "No, let it here." Then Curry and Blymeyer said, "Let's hunt for the book." I said, "Do not touch the book." I said, "Raymeyer was dead." Blymeyer took the light and went upstairs and pulled the blinds down in the room. And Blymeyer said, "While we're here, look for money." Blymeyer took the light and went through the drawers on the second floor. And Blymeyer gave me $3 in change to put in my pockets. And Blymeyer told me to carry it home in my coat pocket. We then came downstairs and hunted for Blymeyer's jacket. And Blymeyer pulled off his jacket and burnt it in the stove. And then I said, "Let's go." Then Blymeyer said we better light the house on fire so they would not get suspicious of us. Then Curry went to work and took the oil lamp and poured the oil over Raymeyer, and I was going to give him a match, and Curry pulled one out of his pocket and gave it to Blymeyer. Blymeyer lit Nelson's clothes. Then we started up over the hill, over the barn, then through the woods, and Blymeyer said he did not believe the house was burning. Blymeyer said, "Let's go back and look." I said, "No, I do not care to go back." And Blymeyer said it again. Then the three of us went back, got into the corn shed.
God.
And Blymeyer wanted to get a bag, although I did not know what he wanted with this. Then I said, "I believe someone is coming down the road." So we went up through the field again. I said, "Come on, let us go home." And so we started home. Raymeyer's clothes were burning when we left the house. The fire on Raymeyer's body flamed up, about 2 inches high when we left the house. All three of us walked from Raymeyer's house to my home. That was a good many miles. So that was a pretty comprehensive and that, conflicting statement
yeah.
as to the events of the night.
I'd believe it. That's horrible.
Horrendous, isn't it? And it's also horrendous because this kid is like, "Oh, let's go." And then he's handed like a bit of wood or a match or something and he just does it anyway. Yeah.
There are
no good parties in that story.
But for that kid, I'm like, the younger child, Curry, he was completely groomed for years for this. Blymeyer probably obviously has deep mental mm-hmm. health problems and things. But this kid's been told to do this by his parents. Yeah.
And he's obviously not, there's a part of him that's obviously not comfortable with it, but you can tell that he's just got like all these people telling him to just do it. So he's just like, "Well, I guess this is normal." And it's just, it's so horrible when you think about it like that.
Yeah. Oh, the worm-lipped hag, whatever they mm-hmm. called her, has a lot of responsibility in this.
No, I mean, she brainwashed a mentally unstable man who brainwashed a child and a probably fairly mentally unstable family. And it was all started by her, the toothless, hunchbacked Emma Knopp. And yet I couldn't find anything on her, at least not in any of the trial reports that I read. But
she probably shape-shifted into
a tree.
Small amazing. Yeah. I don't know how it works.
So, yeah, it was horrible. The trial was extensively covered across the world, as any horrible case is. But it was fairly straightforward, though the Evening News noted that the spectacle of a 14-year-old lad who had never recovered from childhood belief in boogaboos, hobgoblins and witches, on trial for his very life, drew a full courtroom.
Yeah, I bet.
So John Blymeyer was convicted of first-degree murder and sent to life in prison. Wilbert Hess was found guilty and sentenced to spend 10 to 20 years in jail. 14-year-old John Curry was tried separately, but he was eventually found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. The Evening News said that Blymeyer took his conviction with hardly a show of emotion. His face was just a little ashen as he gazed down his long nose at the jurors while the verdict was read. Then he sat down, looked disinterestedly at the judge, bit a fingernail and yawned. "I'm no longer bewitched," he said as he was being led back to jail after hearing the verdict. It was a little stiff, I think, but I never was happier. I can eat and sleep now, and I feel fine. There's no spell over me anymore. And according to The Bee, a paper in Danville, Virginia, Bleymeyer ate a hearty breakfast as he awaited his sentencing and stated that he firmly believed, and still believes, that he did the right thing.
If this was a film, they would set up the sequel or something, or they have a cliffhanger ending, and it would be, or the stinger after the credits, it would be Bleymeyer sitting in his cell, and the librarian for the prison is doing his rounds and he's opening everyone's door or hatch thing and throwing a book in, and then he gets to Bleymeyer and the hatch opens and there's just like a 10 seconds of nothing, and then it closes and the book that was supposed to be in Raymeyer's house would be there.
In Raymeyer's house.
And then the screen would go black.
Okay, so there's a little visual ending for this podcast. That's so great.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, that actually, I'm scared.
Yeah, because you know what? They, like, they didn't even go out and do what they were meant to do. They didn't bury any hair and they didn't destroy any books. So for all they know, they're still cursed.
Do you think maybe it wasn't really about that?
Yeah, I mean, he was looking for money, wasn't he?
Do you think that, yeah, he just wanted to kill him.
That's sick.
God, it's actually doubly bad as well, because it's not doubly bad. I'm not comparing my plight to the plight of a person who's burnt to death and beaten to death and burned. But the way that we record this podcast is that I record one track, Violet records the other, and then I email or whatever my track to Violet, and then it gets edited. But when I listen to my side back to make sure the levels and everything are okay, I can only hear me, and in the bits where I'm silent when you're talking, I'm always really worried that I'm going to hear, like, get out of my house. I'm going to have to emigrate again because I can't deal with that.
Oh, that's so horrible. Why did you say that at the... I was going to say it's getting really late here. It's 8 p.m. here and it's dark. That's not the story that you tell at this point in the podcast. I'm not actually listening back to this track.
That's a joke, but that's also completely true. I listen to it really quietly in case that happens.
I'm just not going to listen to mine at all. I'll just wait for yours to come through and then hope that between the two of us we're loud enough to just, like, block out any extra voices that shouldn't be there.
Yeah. Anyway, that was dismal.
I'm sorry I brought us back to murder with, like, the worst murder I could possibly find.
I know that is the one that has made me feel the most
uneasy,
hollow.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm really just like, that's so grim.
Yeah, sorry about that, man.
Yeah. Anyway, I'd like to tell you that my letter and poem this week are a breath of fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to lie to you. Actually,
what have you done?
The poem's quite clever, actually. But the letter, oh my God. So right at the top, the letter is about the atomic bombs that landed on Nagasaki and
Okay,
Hiroshima.
So you went lighthearted with this one then?
Yeah, you went one death. I went like the Costco. You went boutique shop, I went Costco.
Okay, go on.
This is taken from the Dundee Courier. The Dundee Courier, actually, and it's in the British Newspaper Archive, is one of the best newspapers for letters, I find.
I've found a couple of good ones from there, actually.
Yeah, they really...
those editors were good.
Or those editors needed to fill inches.
True.
So this is from the Wednesday, November 7th, 1945, second page.
Hmm.
And obviously...
High billing for a letter.
The years around sort of 1945 to 1950 are really, really interesting in newspapers, mm-hmm, because of, you know, Russia and the Cold War starting and things going on in Berlin and things. So I do quite like looking at them. And then I came across this guy, and this guy shows that even though we have the internet and everything, we are not different to people from 70 years ago.
Okay.
We still have blowhards, internet trolls, and people who know better than experts, and
yeah.
Currently you know, who are in quite high positions of power.
Maybe we had more of them because you can quite easily pop that bubble of thinking you're an expert in something just by looking at the internet. Whereas in those days, you had to actually like put in a bit of legwork to dispel your theory.
I mean, this could well be from a Russian internet troll now. So the title of the letter is That Atomic Bomb. I hate this guy. Dear sir, when the first reports came out about the devastation occasioned by the atomic bomb, I was sceptical and frequently expressed this opinion to many of my friends. I don't believe this man has many friends.
To many of my friend.
Yeah. To my mum, who I still live with. When the protons and neutrons start a Donnybrook with nuclei, something is bound to happen. But whether it is as devastating as many people have been led to believe, I question. If these various agencies were as powerful as they were claimed to be, the world would have been enveloped. But fortunately, or unfortunately, such was not the case. The split atoms, when they got to work, should have continued ad infinitum. Right?
Yeah.
So he's saying he doesn't believe that the nuclear bombs works because the whole world wasn't destroyed.
Okay.
Which actually was a concern they had. They thought it might ignite the atmosphere. But he continues. Major Dasevsky, the Russian-born US aviation expert, who has been wonderfully correct in his pre-war aviation views, has visited Hiroshima and Nagasaki and makes the following remarks. Quote, "The atomic bomb fires imaginations more than it has fired cities." I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, "Japanese cities are made of flimsy wood structures with heavy tiled roofs, which collapsed immediately. The major's examination of the two cities showed that deaths were caused mainly from fire resulting from the fire hazard. When I saw the first photographs of these two cities, I noticed with satisfaction from my opinionative point of view that while a large part of the cities was devastated, the modern buildings consisting of steel and concrete were left structurally intact, thus supporting my views. The atomic bomb is largely ballyhoo, but the scientists wish to make the most of it. Give me high explosive every time and not so expensive to make. The incendiary bomb was the great success of the war. Yours faithfully, Hepsax, Dundee, November 5th,
1945. What a little
doolally. It's just like...
I was trying so hard not to swear for that bit.
But what's his point? Like, he's saying that the atomic bombs that killed tens and thousands of people...
Also, what has he been reading? What has he been looking at?
Yeah, I definitely would believe a Russian-born US aviation expert.
Yeah.
But it's more like he's lamenting the fact that we didn't destroy more of these cities.
Yeah, and he's like, "Ah, no, I like these ones that destroy even more," in his belief. Yeah. It's like it's a love letter. What's that movie called? It's like the love letter to the
Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah, that one.
It's Doctor Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Atomic Bomb or something.
Yeah, that's the one. What does he sign off as?
Hepsax, which I imagine is a high explosive. Honestly,
you see, if he wrote that on the internet today, he'd have someone like knocking at his door.
But the thing is, if he wrote that on the internet today, that's what all of this truther stuff is. That's what the 9/11 conspiracies are, and that's what the Sandy Hook truthers are, and that's what the birth certificate people were. It's just nonsense that they believe, and they've convinced themselves this is the truth because they found one source that agrees with them.
And you know what? They've been published on page 2 of the Dundee Courier.
Yeah. So as a kind of an amuse-bouche, I guess, a palate cleanser from just misery of the last hour, I have a poem that is actually quite a clever poem.
Is it a light-hearted poem? About bunny rabbits?
No, it's about the gulag.
Okay.
It's about the gulag.
Right.
It's not about the gulag. It's from the 18th of March, 1892.
Okay, great year.
I can't remember. I can't remember the publication it was in. It's from the Welsh newspaper archive. So a correspondent at Reading has sent the following poem on the ladies. On reading it line for line, it will be seen that the sentiments expressed are anything but complimentary to the fair sex.
Okay.
But on reading alternate lines, that is the first and third, and then the second and fourth of each verse, the ladies are credited with all that is good and true.
I see.
So okay. I'll read it both ways.
Uh-huh.
I quite like this because it actually gave me a headache trying to understand how you'd write it. Happy must he pass his life who's free from matrimonial chains. Who is directed by a wife is sure to suffer for his pains.
Adam could find no solid peace when Eve was given for a mate. Until he saw a woman's face, Adam was in a happy state. In the female race appear hypocrisy, deceit, and pride. Truth, darling of the heart sincere, in woman never did reside. What tongue is able to unfold the failings that in woman dwell? The worth in woman we behold is almost imperceptible. Confusion take the man, I say, who makes a woman his delight, who no regard to women pay, has reason always in his sight. So that's the...
That's the bad one. No, yes. That's the good one. The bad one's to come.
No, that was the bad one.
Okay. And then you read it the other way around, and it's just kill, 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 kill.
Yeah, it's like...
All that women play, do.
When you play the White Album backwards.
You better not get married or it will happen to you.
That rhymed. But no, so that was the unpleasant one, where women are the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose a lot of men would have just kind of been like, no, I don't need another one, that's fine. those things are true. The guy who wrote the letter about the atomic bombs probably read just that one and then was like,
that's all the information I need.
This agrees with my estimates of women. So the other way, where you read first and third line, second and fourth, is actually mm-hmm. very nice. Says, happy must he pass his life who is directed by a wife, who's free from matrimonial chains, is sure to suffer for his pains. Adam could find no solid peace until he saw a woman's face. When Eve was given for a mate, Adam was in a happy state. In the female race appear truth, darling of the heart sincere. Hypocrisy, deceit, and pride in a woman never did reside. What tongue is able to unfold the worth in woman we behold? The failings that in woman dwell is almost imperceptible. Confusion take the man, I say, who no regard to women pay, who makes a woman his delight, has reason always in his sight.
Oh, that's cute.
That's far more charming. Yeah. I like to think the guy who wrote it wrote that poem about how much he hated women, and then one of his friends was like, do you realise that if you just do the first and the third? And he's like, I meant to do that.
How do you think he decided which one was going to be the regular way? That if you didn't bother to read the like accompanying article, you wouldn't know that it was good.
Oh, you mean how did he decide to do the bad one?
Yeah.
I suppose the bad one was like wrapping paper. It's just the shit you got to get through before you can get to a Stretch Armstrong. We're ending that on a more pleasant note than the rest of the show.
I feel
good God.
All warm and fuzzy inside now after that really horrible show of atomic bombs and witchcraft murder.
I promise, it's my turn next time. I promise it won't be murder.
Okay, I'll hold you to that. But I mean, it can still be dark without being murder. Someone doesn't have to die for something to be terrible.
That should be a motivational poster. Someone doesn't have to die for something to be terrible.
I'm going to get that printed and just stick it everywhere now.
I'd wear that on a t-shirt.
I'll stick that on my grave.
Okay. No, I don't. What? No. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in.
Thank you so much.
Yesterday's Chip Paper. If you like what you heard or if you have any feedback for us, please, we'd really appreciate it if you rate us and review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help.
Yes, it really does help. And if you'd like to follow us at Paper Podcast, I'll be putting up some photos of people involved in this case. And
a hand-drawn spectrum of witchcraft.
Yes, so you can find out where on the witchcraft spectrum you land.
Ooh, I hope it gets warm. And playing us out, as always, are Al Jolson and Sophie Taylor with the International Rack, thanks to the Free Music Archive.
All of the archives that we use for the researching of this podcast can be found in the episode description.
The International Rack.